Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
In Gibraltar, there's evidence that Neanderthals extracted the feathers of certain birds, only dark feathers, possibly for aesthetic or ceremonial purposes. And while Neanderthals were once presumed to be crude scavengers, we now know they exploited the different terrains on which they lived. They took down dangerous game, including an extinct species of rhinoceros. Some ate seals and other marine mammals. Some ate shellfish. Some ate chamomile. They had regional cuisines. They used toothpicks.
That's John Mualim reading an excerpt from his essay, Neanderthals Were People Too. It's one of 13 essays in John's book, Serious Face. He's a longtime writer at large for the New York Times Magazine and has contributed to This American Life and 99% Invisible. If you read only one essay collection this year, you're not reading nearly enough essay collections. Seriously, though, I highly recommend you check out Serious Face. It's one of the funniest, smartest, and most perceptive essay collections I've ever read. John has a way of including details that only he could come up with, whether he's writing about his bullfighting doppelganger or his weekly pandemic conversations with the iconoclastic screenwriter Charlie Kaufman. John joins us now to talk about Serious Face and the central question that ties all of the essays together.
Yeah, that was something that I had to put some real thought into as I was assembling the collection. And I don't think as I've gone through the process of scouting out these stories and writing them over the last dozen or so years that I had ever thought of myself as engaged in some kind of big cohesive project. But when I laid these pieces all out and had to think hard about how to introduce them, I thought about a line popped into my head from a poem that I'd read about 20 years ago. And the line was just, why are we not better than we are? And suddenly that kind of jolted me into thinking, well, you know, I think that is sort of the, maybe not always the question that I was asking as I was going through the process of writing these stories, but definitely the question that is underneath a lot of the questions I'm asking. And not just in a moral sense, like, why are we not perfect angels who always do the ethically right thing? But also just like, why can't we get stuff done that we want to get done sometimes? You know, why do projects we embark on sometimes collapse for reasons that seem out of our control? Why are we not, more on it or more efficient or more capable? It just seems like there's a lot of human folly in these stories, inevitable human folly, which I think I've always tried to just kind of accept as part of life and not be too judgmental about.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. And yeah, and I think it's that inevitable human folly that permeates these essays that makes them so interesting to read. We can really relate to them. Has writing these essays helped you come up with an answer to the question, why are we not better than we are?
I'd like to say yes, and I'd like to uncork some beautiful little aphorism here to settle the question. But no, I don't think there is an answer. You know, I think if anything, I think looking for an answer has been a huge dead end and distraction for me in some ways. Like, as my brain's been humming along, examining all these, you know, different people's lives and different situations, that it's sort of fruitless to ask why. And instead just accepting that there is no answer can kind of give you a greater sympathy and compassion for people who are sort of demonstrating that we're not as good as we imagine we could be.
Yeah. Let's talk about your essay, This Is My Serious Face. The story starts when your two friends emailed you an old black and white photo. Can you tell us about the photo?
Yeah, these were some friends of mine who were living in Spain at the time, and I get an email from them, and there's no subject line, there's no body to the email, it's just a photograph. And yet I knew why they sent it to me right away. It was a photograph of a photograph they had seen on a wall of a restaurant of a matador, a black and white photograph of this young matador. And I knew why they'd sent it to me, because it was obvious that this guy looked exactly like me. So, you know, for a while, I would just show that picture to other friends and we'd all laugh about it. And then, you know, years later, it took me years to actually be curious, well, who was this guy? And I figured out his name was Manolete. He was one of the most famous and renowned as the best bullfighter of his era in the 1940s. And when I bought a biography of him, I opened it up, excited to read about my doppelganger. And actually, the first sentence that I read, this is no joke, the first sentence I read said, he has a face that's as dreary as a third-class funeral on a rainy day. because apparently he was ugly. Everyone thought he was ugly. Everyone could not stop talking about how ugly he was. Everyone was taking cheap shots about his looks. And so I was sort of confronted with the ugly truth, I guess, about this guy who looked just like me.
Yeah. At one point, he's described even as remarkably ugly. And if you don't mind my asking, how did that make you feel about your own face, since there is this fairly strong resemblance between the two of your faces?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the amusing thing about it, and I think why I ended up writing about it, is because it didn't really faze me at all. I just was really, I was kind of delighted by it, and you know, I thought it was hilarious because, I mean, for one thing, I think just saying someone has a sort of blanket ugliness, it feels like a pretty old-fashioned, you know, narrow-minded way of looking at the human form, right? So I sort of didn't buy into that to begin with. And then second of all, you know, I like the way I look. I mean, my face is it's pretty crooked, as I describe in the piece. It sort of never looks like I'm looking right at you because my chin is jutting out in one way and my nose is going in the other. And, you know, that it took definitely not in adolescence, probably not even in my early 20s, but eventually I made peace with the way I look, and I like the way I look. So yeah, to me, it was sort of it was amusing to sit that the situation I'd been thrown in felt, you know, almost like a satirical kind of short story or something. And at the same time, it made me realize kind of how far I had come, that I could just weather it so well.
Yeah, I like the way you look too. And a lot of readers who read your essay when it appeared in the New York Times magazine recently commented and said that, you know, you're a good looking guy.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I guess it was all a ploy to get America to tell me that I'm handsome.
Yeah, and it seemed to have worked. What else did you find besides the facial resemblance? Did you find any other things when you did this research into Manolete's life, any other common denominators between the two of you?
Yeah, and that's really why I think it wound up turning into kind of more of a profound essay, because the fact that he was ugly, quote unquote, just it becomes a kind of comic setup to everything else I learned about his life, which was that, you know, he was very ambivalent and conflicted about bullfighting, not for any 21st century ethical enlightenment reasons, but just because he didn't enjoy it, and he felt sort of abused by his audiences. He was, you know, later in his career, they sort of got bored with him because he was just too good, and he thought about he wanted to retire, and he planned on retiring until he was drawn back in by a very brash, kind of loudmouth, younger matador who was manufacturing a kind of rivalry with Manolete. And in a way, I identified with that because, you know, I describe in the piece, I live with a lot of kind of pain and discomfort because of basically the way my face is shaped. It's caused, you know, a lot of headaches and sinus problems and all that. And, you know, I think it's a question of the scale of our situations is different. He's fighting bulls and I'm having headaches. But in a sense, there's this question, which I think we can all relate to in any number of ways, which is when you seem destined for something, when you seem like you're designed to do a certain thing, and yet you feel ambivalent about that thing and you want to find a way out, is the noble thing to do to kind of, you know, accept it and muscle up to accomplish whatever it is you're supposed to accomplish and what people expect of you, or is the braver thing to kind of forge your own path? And I think it's easy to say, oh, we all forge our own paths, but sometimes, you know, that's exactly what we're not supposed to do. We're supposed to just kind of accept our fate, and that's a very Zen thing to do. And the problem I'm grappling with that piece is just how impossible sometimes it is to find that line between acceptance and defeat.
Mm, yeah. You describe your own face as a conversation piece. If you don't mind my asking, what do people say about your face?
The first question I always get is, when did you break your nose, right? Because my nose is kind of, you know, bumpy and crooked. And to my knowledge, I never did break my nose. So that's you know, that's kind of a non-starter. It just kind of, things just kind of grew that way. And then, you know, as I've been writing more and more, and, you know, pictures of me have been on the internet, I've received a lot of unsolicited feedback about my appearance from the good people of the World Wide Web. One guy said my face looked like something Dali would paint, like a smirking camembert melting in the sun, which, I applaud the literary flourish, at least. So, yeah, I don't know. I just think it's, you know, it's natural. We're all kind of checking each other out, you know, when you're talking to someone, their face is right in front of you. I don't begrudge anyone asking about it.
Mm-hmm. Because, and as we were discussing a few minutes ago, yeah, you like the way your face looks, and I do, and so do so many others do too. Let's talk about your essay about the screenwriter Charlie Kaufman. You actually took kind of a Kaufman-esque approach to it, especially with the way you opened the essay with an excerpt from your first draft. Did you experience any pushback from your editor at the New York Times Magazine for wanting to start with something that was originally not going to be part of the profile?
No, to their credit, no. I mean, this was a really peculiar situation in the sense that I was, Charlie Kaufman is known as a screenwriter, but he had written a novel that was coming out, and I was going to do a profile of him. I was supposed to go to New York to meet him for the first time on, I believe, like March 12th, 2020. So that was just as COVID was really starting to shut everything down. And by the time I had turned in a draft of the piece, which was then done just through a series of really long and meandering phone calls with Charlie over the course of a few months, by the time I turned in that draft, then suddenly George Floyd had been murdered. I think that week I turned it in, and the world was erupting in protests and anger. And suddenly, it seemed a little weird maybe to publish 8,000 words of two white guys talking about their feelings on the phone in a weekly news magazine. The draft was handed back to me with basically not very specific, but very adamant feedback, like, what can we do something about this, change it. And I just tried to think about what is the one thing I've learned about this guy through all of our many hours of talking to each other. And I think what I learned about him was just that, like, how, almost addicted he is to honesty, that he just can't not be honest about things. And that's caused a lot of problems for him, I think, in his career. But it's also kind of his gift and what he brings to all of his scripts. And I just thought, well, how can I be honest about what happened? And it wasn't really a gimmick or anything like that. Just the only way I saw through this situation was just to confess that I was in this impossible situation and I had turned in this other draft, and for reasons we all knew and intuited, it was not going to work, and grapple with that problem in the piece itself rather than try to solve it.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever hear back from Charlie after your essay about him, the profile, was published?
Yeah, I did. We've stayed in touch a little bit. He had told me in advance that he did not plan to read the story. I don't know that he reads a lot of his press or anything like that, and I could certainly understand why. And nothing I wrote, helped or harmed our relationship, I guess. And at the same time, it's pretty strange that, we would talk for several hours every Wednesday for probably 10 weeks, the first 10 weeks of the pandemic. And that was such a bizarre time when everything felt so confusing. And I think that was partly why our conversations became so intimate. And then I think when the story was done, it was a little awkward. I felt, like we even talked about it. We're like, well, we probably won't talk too much again, or, we may even never meet. It was just sort of a bizarre cliff to drop off at the end.
Did the fact that you had so much access to him, that you were able to talk to him so many times, and the conversations, as you said, were very intimate, did you feel more pressure then when you were writing the profile, the essay about how to write it and what you could and couldn't say about Kaufman?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, I often have this feeling, I really always have this feeling when I'm doing any kind of reporting that, you're thrown into these situations. And in this case, it was just a series of bizarrely intimate phone calls, but it could have been, it could have been the basis for any of the stories in this book. And you've just taken in reality. You've just taken in this huge dose of another reality. And it always feels overwhelming to kind of distill that into prose. We have to take this huge sweep of chaos and somehow cram it through a funnel and spit it out the other end as a linear sequence of words. And that's insane. I mean, it's just like an insane thing to try to do. So I definitely felt it with Charlie, but it's not an unfamiliar feeling at all. It's something I feel all the time.
Mm-hmm. What do you want your readers to take away from your essays?
I'm not sure I know how to explain it so well, except to say that, well, I don't know, maybe it's my narcissism or something. I can only start with what I take out of them and hope that is also transmitted. But like for me, the experience of doing this kind of narrative journalism for so long has just been such a great gift and just changed my, it sent me to all these different places and introduced me to all these different people and situations. And that's given me this kind of awe about the world, that this conviction, I think that if you pay close enough attention to anything, it's fascinating and often literally life-affirming in the sense that, like, it reminds you about the volume and the richness of life on Earth. And, you know, that's the way I feel. You know, on my best days, that carries over into my non-writing life too, that feeling of kind of delight and amusement about the world. At a minimum, I would just kind of hope to give a glimpse of that same feeling to people.
John Mooallem, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Serious Face. It's one of the funniest, smartest, and most perceptive essay collections I've ever read. As Seinfeld's Jay Peterman would say,
that is interesting writing.
Thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you.
John Mooallem is the author of the essay collection Serious Face. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Josh Gondelman, Chelsea Beaker, and John Mooallem. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our technical director and producer is Steve Gotcher.
There's no darling Steve.
Our executive producer and senior formatting manager is Adam Friedrich.
Thanks, big guy. Thanks, boss. Now he's in charge of me at work for some reason.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
There's no, like, sweet Doug.